We have a speaker tonight, and this is a very special lady to me. I've known Gay through the years, but especially these last couple of years since Cindy passed, and she's become my sponsor, and I follow her around in service work in Macon, and I've learned so much from her about the General Service Organization and service work and how important it is. And I'm sober today, so I guess it speaks for itself. So let's welcome Gay Garner.
I think she used to say we were 220 plugged into a 120 socket. My name is Gay Garner. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be sober and to be here. Happy birthday. Where's the other gentleman who had a birthday? Well, happy birthday. Yes, it's a wonderful, great testimony to how AA works and that it does work. And we know we do it one day at a time. But, you know, Cindy always used to tell me, you got to put those days together if you're going to grow and if you're going to learn. And so I've always known that the birthdays are important, but it's very important to stay sober one day at a time. I'd like to introduce my husband, Al. Al is a great Al-Anon. His life is as much a miracle as mine is. And I think our story is really about the destruction of a family through alcoholism and then the healing of a family through the programs of AA and Al-Anon. And I do believe that this is a family illness, and I don't think anybody gets away. Everybody is affected by the illness. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about my family. I also want to tell you my sobriety date is March the 14th, 1976, and I am a member of the Clarkson 12-Step Group, and I have been since the beginning of my sobriety. That's where I choose to put my energy, efforts, and financial support and service outside of AA as a whole, but that's where my center is. That's where I go to get filled and refilled, and I love my home group. Cindy Tracy, which I know many of you knew Cindy, was my sponsor for 33 years until she passed away, and as a result, Tanya and Gail and a few other people who I'm just delighted to have. When I got sober in the east side of Atlanta, there were no women. So when I first went to AA, I was just surrounded by nothing but old-timer men, which were wonderful. But I finally, you know, to get a sponsor, had to come up here, up north, to find a woman sponsor. And somebody gave me the telephone number of Cindy T. And I called her, and she met me at a little old Waffle House out here off of 285. Had never seen her before, didn't know who she was, and asked her if she would help me get sober. And she said yes, and we were connected ever since that time. And I have to tell you, I miss her. I miss her. At first, you know, I cried about it a lot, though, like I said. But then after a couple weeks, when some things really began to go on with me, as they do with us life on life's term, I really began to miss her. So I did what the program teaches us to do. I got a sponsor. Her name is Marge Kay. She is from Cumming, so I'm still up in this sort of area. I guess Cumming is kind of up here, isn't it? And anyway, she's wonderful, and God has certainly blessed me. I never knew what a gift Cindy T was going to be in my life. She was the most wonderful sponsor. She was completely engulfed in the steps and the traditions. She knew that that's where the solution was. Anytime I had a problem, that's where she guided me. She always answered her telephone. She was wonderful. And I try to give back to the girls I sponsor the wonderful things that she gave to me. There was none of this stuff, don't call me after 11, you know, because I'll be in bed. I mean, I could call her, and I did a couple times call her, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning when I was having some problems. And she was always there, always took the time to talk to me, was always there for me, always put me in the solution. And I really believe that the quality of my sobriety today, I know I've had to work the steps and do the work myself, but was really based on the guidance and the direction from Cindy. And some of the, we have conversations. I talk to Cindy all the time. Somebody said to me one time, I hope that new girl did not hear you say that. That you're out there talking to dead people. I said, no, but I do, you know, because I know, I was with Cindy long enough to know that when I had something I needed to talk about, I knew what she would say to me. I knew what she would say to me. So anyway, I do have a little conversation with Cindy all the time. Most of the time, I try not to take Cindy's part. I let her have her part. I have my own part. But anyway, I love this program. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love alcoholics. It's just the greatest thing that has ever happened to me, and I feel really grateful that when it came my time to come, that I came, and I was here, and that you were here, and that you have helped me see sober one day at a time. And it has been quite a journey. And it's certainly not over with yet. I didn't have a particularly good day today. And I told Tanya, I said, oh, I'm really sorry I'm talking tonight. You know, because I like to talk when I'm really up and flying. And I hadn't been up and flying today. But, you know, life goes on. I don't care how sober you are. Life and its problems still come, and you still have to deal with them. And I am so grateful in this day and time that we live in, and, you know, the chaos that's in the world and the corruption that's in the world, that I have a place like Alcoholics Anonymous to come to, you know, that's spiritual and that's caring and that cares about me and gives me an opportunity to care about others and to do service. And I'm very grateful for that. And Al is also involved a lot in service. And I'm very grateful for that because we understand what we're doing in our house, you know, and there's never any problem with that. Everybody is very supportive of everybody, you know, following the principles of AA and Al-Anon. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my family. My father was an alcoholic, and he passed away 2 weeks before I had my first birthday in AA as a direct result of alcoholism. He had come to live with me and was my drinking partner, and as I got sober that first year, I watched him die of this illness. My mother was what the big book described as a heavy drinker, which given the right set of reasons, will stop. I believe that that's what Al is too. And I'm not trying to take his inventory, but he says that in his story up here, that he was a heavy drinker, which given the right set of circumstances, chooses not to drink today. And I am grateful for that, although I do realize that that has nothing to do with my sobriety. But it certainly does make life a lot easier for me. I'm really glad that he chooses not to drink. He's been in Al-Anon. I've been sober for 34 years, and he's been in Al-Anon about 29. Our stories are a little different than you generally hear. Usually the woman is, you know, gets to the Al-Anon before the drunk gets, or the Al-Anon gets to their program before we get to ours. But we kind of reversed the situation a little bit, which should give you a good indication about how sick Al really was, because it took him to stay married to an alcoholic woman all those years. It took him, you know, 5 more years to get to Al-Anon. But his life has changed drastically, dramatically, just like mine has, through working the principles of the program. So we are pretty grateful. I have a older brother who died as a direct result of alcoholism when he was 40 years old. He was an artist, a beautiful artist. And I know that everything is in divine order, but I can't help but feel sometimes that what a waste of talent and life, you know, that alcohol does really rob us of that. And I have a younger brother who is an alcoholic also. Everybody in my family is an alcoholic. And he was a career man in the Air Force. He finally had to quit flying because he was so frightened to fly, finally, as his alcoholism progressed. He's been hospitalized probably 5 or 6 times for alcoholism. He's been to meetings with me. I've made sure that he has all the pamphlets and the big book and all that. And but he, it just does not choose to be a way of life for him yet. The people in AA gave me a great gift because I had so much alcoholism in my family that they just told me that the best thing that I could do was to stay sober, live the principles of this program, and show them a better way to live, if that should ever be their decision. And that I really had enough to do to mind my own business and take care of my own alcoholism. You know, Cindy constantly pumping into my head, You just got to realize that people don't think like you do, and you've got to mind your own business and take care of your own alcoholism and do what you need to do for you. And that's what I've tried to do. And I think that Al and I finally did carry that message to our children. I mean, we took a lot of sickness into the family, you know, with our alcoholism. But also we've taken a lot of healing and a lot of wellness into the family through the program. We have three children, three daughters. The oldest one, who we thought for a long time had escaped the alcoholism bit. She's very different than we are. She's a health nut. She runs. She exercises. She's a wonderful single mother. And she eats right. She does all those things that none of us have ever really done. And for the longest time, she's 51. And for the longest time, years, she sipped on a half a glass of wine. For years. And we thought, you know, she finally had maybe escaped this thing. And then all of a sudden, she started drinking martinis. So she's drinking martinis in the evening time, and then she gets a couple bottles of wine, and she finishes off a couple bottles of wine. So we're just waiting for her, you know. We can see the empty chairs here, and she certainly knows where to go if indeed it ever becomes a problem for her. So far, it doesn't look like it's interfered with her regular life. But, you know, we know how that goes. Sometimes it looks pretty good on the outside, and we're never really quite sure what's going on the inside. Lori, my middle daughter, our middle daughter, I'm learning to do that. I'm learning to identify Al with the children. I'm really bad to say my this, my that. You know how we are, my this, my that. So, our middle daughter, Lori, has been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 30 years. It's been a very sad story, and I don't have to tell you, we've all been there. Her life reflects that of alcoholism and drugs. And she's had a rough time, and she stays sober for a period of time, and then she's out again. She's really responsible for my service work, and I'll tell you a little about that a little bit later. Right now, we think she's doing pretty good, you know. So, you know, our prayers are for her every day that, you know, she will find the program again. She periodically goes to meetings. Our youngest daughter, Allison, is a member of Narcotics Anonymous. She just celebrated her 5th birthday. She has 6 years in AA. Both girls started out in AA and then gravitated towards, I think, what they consider themselves to be as drug addicts who drank. I think there are drug addicts who drank, and there are drinkers who drink drugs. And they fall into that category. So they are more comfortable in NA, and they're wonderful. They're great singleness of purpose people. They believe in that. They talk a lot about it and are very supportive of that. And I've been to the NA meetings with them on their birthdays and things, and very supportive of the meetings they go to. They were wonderful meetings. So if anybody ever tells you that there's no good NA meetings out there, that's not true. There's wonderful meetings out there, and they're solid and they're strong, and they are coming of age as we have come of age. So I'm most grateful for NA and for what they've been through. So we kind of have a little family of recovery, you know. So it's really what everybody kind of understands what everybody's doing. As I'm able to look back on my life through this inventory process, there were some telltale signs there, of course, that I didn't recognize. I always very kind of a naive, shy type person. I'm the kind of drunk that sat in the corner and cried and never opened my mouth. You know, Cindy used to say the first two guys of alcoholics come into AA, one's like me, who sits in the corner and can't say boo, and the other one is like her, who comes in with the foot in the mouth, and we're, you know, we're all trying to do the same thing, and that is learning how to express ourselves in principle in love. And that has been one of the greatest challenges for me, and one of the greatest things that I've been able to do is to learn how to express myself in principle and in love. I heard a lady say in a meeting one time that I really think it's true for me, is that the beginning of resentment is my inability to express myself lovingly and in principle. And so I really try to do that, and most of the time it works. But it took me a long time before I was able to really speak up and speak out. I think service probably helped me in that area more than anything else, and I have often thought wish that I could run my personal life as well as I've been able to do in the service life. I was raised in Omaha, Nebraska, the oldest of four children. I am a jazz musician. I had a musical gift, of which I am very grateful for today, of which AA helped me to become grateful. It was never good enough until I got sober and learned how to turn that around and be grateful for what I could do. So, very grateful for that. I did very well in school. I was a straight-A student. I was into a lot of activity because of the music, and I did very well. I was really very naive, and, you know, Bill talks a lot in literature about living, being able to separate fantasy from reality, and I really totally lived in a fantasy world. I really did think everything was wonderful and okay. I loved the movies. It was in the 50s, the year of the movies. The boy always got the girl always got the boy, and everything ended wonderful. And I really thought that's the way my life was going to go. I thought I would grow up, find my soulmate, get married. I've been reading a lot of those True Confession magazines, so I figured I'd, you know, meet my soulmate, and we'd ride off into the sunset and live happily ever after. And boy, was I sure it was a shock on that one. Anyway, I graduated from school, several honor societies, straight A's, and because of the music, I had wanted to go to New York and study music, and because my family were financially well off, it was arranged that I go to New York and study at Juilliard School of Music. So I left Omaha at 18 years old to go to Juilliard and to hopefully become a famous musician. And that was also another rude awakening. That did not happen. When I got to New York, things seemed to be very good for me. Although the one thing too that I'm able to look back and see is Bill talks about our inability to form a true and lasting relationship. I left Omaha, 18 years old, had gone to school with the same kids all my life, gone to camp, gone to scouts, gone to Sunday school and everything, and I left and never had a connection with one person. Never had a best friend or anything. And as I look back, it always seemed to me like I was surrounded by a lot of people and I had a lot of friends. But I really know today, through the program, that I really didn't have an interconnection with anybody, unless it was family. And then if it was family, that was a different story. But I look at Al's in my life, and Al ended up being in television and radio, and we were always surrounded by a lot of people, and it looked like we had lots and lots of friends. But you know what? When it came time to go, we left, and we never had a connection with anybody. And that was kind of the story of us. So I could really see my inability to form a true and lasting relationship. It looked good on the outside, but there was nothing going on the inside. I went to Juilliard, very successful, loved it, was living with a maiden aunt, had a couple things happen. Up until this time, I really had not had a drink to have a drink. Now, my parents drank at home and were social, did social stuff all the time, and I was always offered booze at home, but I was not interested in it. I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't run with a group of kids that drank, and it just was not a part of my life. So when I was in New York and I was going around with my agent is when I really had my first drink. I had a drink. And the drug followed very shortly after that. I got very sick, got home living with a maiden aunt, and she asked me, you know, what was wrong with me, and I told her I had eaten something that had not agreed with me, and the significance for me on that is that I always lied about my drinking from the very beginning, when it wasn't even necessary to lie about drinking. I always lied about my drinking. The other thing about my early drinking was I seemed to have an enormous capacity to hold alcohol. And I did up until the time right before I came into the program when I had no tolerance for alcohol at all. But there was a time when I, you know, could have been the designated driver, the designated of anything, because I just drank an awful lot. I remember, too, never just having a drink. Once we started drinking, we just drank and drank. Not getting drunk all the time, but there was never such a thing as just having a drink. When we set out to drink, we drank. I was very successful in New York. I had jobs. I had a couple things happening to me there. I was approached by the several of the local prostitution rings and asked me if I was interested in joining. And I really wasn't. And, you know, my naivety says, well, people don't really do that, you know. So anyway, I wasn't interested in doing that. And I was the drug of the jazz world was heroin at that time. And I was daily offered heroin. And I was not interested in that. I really had a mental thing with, this is booze, which is a beverage, and this is drugs over here, and ne'er the twain do meet. So to me, that was drugs, and that was dangerous, and that was a no-no, and I never touched. To this day, I never even smoked a marijuana cigarette. I left that for all my kids to do, and they made up for all the stuff that I didn't do. They did it all for me. So anyway, and then I got myself involved with a married man. And I didn't know he was married at the time, but I found out through a series of events. And the naivety that I spoke about is that, you know, that would have been all. I just wasn't smart enough to keep it to myself. I had to call my mom and dad and tell them all of that stuff that was going on and everything. Of course, and, you know, this is in the 50s, and the world was a lot friendlier place and loving and kind. And this kind of stuff, you know, just you didn't hear about this kind of stuff like you do today. So the next thing I knew, my dad was on a plane for New York, and he came there and talked to me and said that, you know, this is not the kind of life that he wanted me to live. And he felt like if I lived in it long enough, and I do understand that today, I didn't think, if you live in it long enough, then you get accepting of it, and then you become a part of it. So he said, I would like you to come home. And he had relocated in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and go to school, go to college, meet a nice young man, get married, and live happily ever after. And I thought that sounded pretty good. So that's what I did. And I really thought for the longest time until I got sober that that was the beginning of my problems, that that was what was wrong with me, that he had not left me alone, had not left me in New York to pursue my career and become famous. And I really realized after I got sober, probably about 5 years of sobriety, that really that that was just a situational thing that happened, and I made the choice to go home. But I had a terrible resentment for him. I thought if he hadn't come up there and gotten me, you know, who knows, my life probably would have been just wonderful. Well, anyway, I came back and I enrolled in Wake Forest College. And by then, I had had some drinks. I had had several drunks at that time. Wake Forest was run by the Baptist State Convention. And you couldn't even hold hands on campus. And I mean, you didn't let alone dance or drink or anything like that. I mean, it was really, really boring, very dull, very low-key. The professors even walked down the hall and with rulers to make sure that there was 6 inches between your shoulder and the guy that you were walking with. So, you know, it was pretty, you know, pretty boring. I fell in immediately with the 5 people who drank on campus. They were all in the theater group. Al was a part of that group, and that's how I met Al. And we started to date. And anyway, it was very soon after that that I got pregnant. Now, I don't think that that was from holding hands or from walking too close. You know, I really walked around for a long time thinking, how did this happen to me? How did this happen to me? How did I get this? This naivety of not being able to take responsibility for my actions, and that followed me until I got sober. So I finally got, this was the first time that I had had any problems with wanting to kill myself or wanting to run away or escape or geographical or anything. It was a horrible burden on my family. It was like the plague back in the 50s, in the mid-50s, for something like this to happen. There was no options for young women at that time. You either went to the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers, or you went to some dark, dingy barroom someplace and got an abortion. And there just wasn't, or you married the guy. Well, I think they all have their price tags, but I married the guy, and my mother arranged for that. She was really a pretty powerful woman, so I don't think anybody asked Al what he wanted to do, and nobody asked me what I wanted to do. She just arranged the marriage. Now, Al was in his last year of law school at Wake Forest. Now, it took me 5 years of getting sober to realize that that series of events might have upset his life a little bit. Anyway, so it was arranged for us, and they shipped us off to a place called Stark, Florida, which is a little podunk city, if you know where it is, right outside of Jacksonville, so that nobody would ever know what happened to us, you know. So anyway, things rocked on, and Julie was born, and then we had two daughters after that, and Al, of course, didn't have an opportunity to finish his law school, and he got involved in radio work, which he loved, and he's had a reputation of being one of the best radio men in the country, and still does. And so he started his career in that, and the marriage was just an absolute disaster. This wonderful thing of riding off into the sunset. Boy, I'm telling you, it left a lot to be desired. And but it's funny, and I thought about it and inventoried it, but, you know, you just didn't tell anybody it wasn't working. You didn't want anybody to know because you felt like that was a reflection against you. What is wrong with you that you cannot make this marriage work? So I set off on an obsession to make this thing work that nearly killed us all. But anyway, you know, I was just, I lived by the philosophy is I'm going to get up Monday morning and everything is going to be fine. You know, it's going to be okay. Or if I try a little bit harder, maybe if I read some more of those articles in Home Housekeeping or something like that. I think the only thing I never did do is meet him at the door and saran wrap. But I did everything, and I just couldn't make anything work. So you sort of surrender yourself that this is the way it is. And, you know, God has really dealt you a lousy hand, you know, and you're just going to have to live with it. Now, I tried to find some answers because I was really in trouble on the inside. So I went to every church. I thought maybe there might be an answer for me there. And, of course, the drinking is escalating all this time, you know, as the unhappiness is going on. I tried all of the major churches and a few of the minor ones, and couldn't say. I never knew that I was going to have to do any work in this area. I just thought that there was some magic answer out there somewhere, that if I just got to the right place at the right time, I would get it. I never knew I was going to have to work steps and traditions and things like that. And, I mean, I never knew that I had to participate in any of that spiritual learning until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and was presented with the steps and the work that I had to do in order for it to change my life. I remember one time I went into a Catholic church and lit a candle and came out. I wasn't even Catholic. And went in and came out, and I thought my life would change. And, you know, it didn't change. I didn't know I would have to do inventory work and help others and, you know, pray and do all that kind of stuff. And they talk about people who do not know rightly how to pray. I know when I first met Cindy, she suggested I go home and pray. And I said, well, I was real sorry that I didn't believe in prayer, that I tried it and it had not worked for me. And she just said, I don't care what you believe in. You go home and you get on your knees and you pray, because that's what works. And you've got nothing to lose. And fortunately, unlike a lot of the new people that I know today, I never questioned what she said to me. I did exactly what she told me to do. And I went home. And I can remember how uncomfortable I was. You know, I locked the door, so God forbid the kids or Al would see me on my knees praying. And at the best I can remember, it was very simple, like, God, please help me, you know, stay sober. Like you hear in the meetings when you're new. And I know today, as I'm able to look back, that that was really the beginning of a conscious contact with a higher power. And I didn't even know. So that's kind of how my journey there started. But anyway, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So anyway, the drinking progressed. Al was working in Houston at the time, and a famous entertainer came through, and he wasn't getting any record play, and he talked to Al, and Al got him a lot of good record play, to the fact that he hired him to create, to build three radio stations for him. The first one was to be in Knoxville, and then one in Augusta, and then one finally in Baltimore. So we had the three children at the time. Al and I, drink-wise, we partied a lot, we drank a lot. I don't remember a lot of outside problems as a result of alcohol, but there was a lot going on inside. I was in really severe trouble inside. We went to Knoxville, and Al put the radio station on the air there, and some things really began to happen for me. Now the drinking has really escalated. for me. I'm a housewife, Rose, and you know, people kind of feel sorry for us because nothing really exciting ever happens to us, you know. We just kind of go to the bedroom and drink ourselves to death one day at a time, you know. And when I first got sober, it was 2 years before I heard a good drunk housewife story. I mean, I was hearing these bizarre stories of people waking up in China with strange people and just really weirdo stuff. And I mean, I'm just waking up in my bed, you know, sometimes clothed, sometimes not clothed. But anyway, I was there all alone, yeah, with my bottle. But anyway, that's how my drinking really went, you know, the whole time that I drank. But some things began to happen to me. I developed a horrible fear of nighttime. Anytime the sun went down and it got dark, I was absolutely terrified. And I started sleeping with guns and billy clubs and knives. And I would get the three children and I would get them all in the bedroom. And then I would lock the bedroom door and then I would barricade the door. And then I would have that little arsenal there. Al was doing a lot of traveling, so he wasn't home a lot. So I don't know what I thought was going to get me, but I was going to be ready. And Al said, if anybody ever walks in this bedroom and sees your arsenal there, they're not going to, you know, they're going to get out of there as quick as they can. But this followed me until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, this horrible fear of nighttime. The other thing is I had a horrible fear of the automobile. I did not know how to drive. I was 30 years old. I had never learned how to drive. So my relationship with my mother had gotten quite close because I think, as I understand it through the program, that my dependency, I tried to put I am a dependent person. Thank God AA has put that dependency where it's safe. It's on AA as a whole and higher power. But I've always tried to put it on people, places, and things. And when it wouldn't go to Al, because he was working on his own sicknesses, I transferred it to my mother, and she really became my higher power. And she would come visit me, and I would look forward to it. And I had a lot of good stuff going on in my life. But, you know, we alcoholics, I think, are just naturally drawn to depression and negativity, and so I was always drawn to the negative side of what was going on. The kids were great. Al was not home a lot because he was doing a lot of traveling, so he really didn't know what was going on. But this is when I begin to do all those things that seem to be really peculiar to an alcoholic, like buying liquor by the pint and watering down booze and loading my drinks and all that kind of stuff. This is when this began to happen, and I became a daily drinker. And but my mother did come, and she did teach me how to drive the car, and until I got sober in AA, I never drove over 25 miles an hour. I was scared to death. I never drove if it rained, and my world had become so small as the alcoholism was closing in. I mean, I could get to the grocery store, to the bank, to the liquor store, and where the kids were in school. That was my world. I had done some working professionally, but it finally got to the point where I couldn't even do that anymore. Not only because of the alcoholism, but I believe because I had become so ungrateful for the gift that God had given me, that it just sort of atrophied. And I just couldn't play anymore. And, of course, I was in and up too. I say, you know, I was in and up under the piano more than I was at the piano, so that wasn't really good. So we told everybody I wasn't working anymore because the crime was so horrible. So anyway, we lived in Augusta for a short period of time. Oh, I do have to tell you now that I live in Atlanta. I drive 285. I'm like a mad woman behind the wheel of my car. I have to pray before I get in there because I have done a complete turnaround with the driving. But when I first got sober, it was so wonderful because I was so afraid. And, of course, if you went to meetings, and Al's not there, you go to meetings at night. I mean, you've got to go when it's dark. You've got to go when it's raining and snowing and all that stuff. So I would get ready to get on 285, and I'd say, okay, God, it's just you and me. And I am not kidding you, that freeway was clear. And I would just go. And, of course, once I began to learn how to do it properly, that didn't happen anymore. And certainly it doesn't happen anymore today. But when I needed that to happen for me, to get to a meeting where I needed to get to, it did. It worked. It was just remarkable. We put a station together in Augusta, and the drinking is escalating. And then we were only in Augusta for 6 months and then on to Baltimore. And I got a call one Thanksgiving morning that my mother died suddenly. and my world just absolutely fell apart. I felt like I had been thrown on the world. She had been my higher power. She had been, she would, well, I know we had what a mutual admiration society. We sat around and told each other how wonderful we thought each other was. And I needed that. I mean, I needed somebody to tell me that I was special and that I counted and I meant something to somebody. And I needed that at that time. And so anyway, my world just fell apart. So I started going to seances, and I went to the library and checked out all the books on how you reach people who passed over on the other side, and I started all that stuff trying. And sometimes drunk, sometimes sober. I think it's really remarkable I never reached her because, you know, the way our drunk minds work, you would have thought I could have created that somewhere down the line. And I began to also get very physically sick. I had sores all over my body. My hair all fell out. I got swellings in my hands and feet and my throat. It was bruises. A series of doctors in the hospital to find out what was wrong with me. And I thought it was really interesting. All the doctors seemed to think I was allergic to something. But nobody ever seemed to be able to find out, you know, what it was, you know, some kind of fruit or some kind of fish or something like that. So when I finally got sober, I was able to ride that doctor and tell him what I was really allergic to. Anyway, so I got pretty sick. And things were going bad with Al, the entertainer that he'd gotten involved with, but in trouble with the law and the IRS, and with anything you could be in trouble with, he was in trouble with. And a lot of things began, a lot of real frightening things began to happen to us. Like, you know, they were taking our cars and taking our furniture and taking our bank accounts and everything like that. So it became, along with all that impending doom that the alcoholic seems to have, you know, this legitimate stuff was going on. So at that time, we found out that we would be moving to Atlanta. My dad had come to live with me, and he'd become my drinking partner. Al was still traveling. So what the pattern would be for us would be we'd sit around all day long and drink and talk about my mother and talk about how lucky we'd been to have her. And then I would generally pass out somewhere mid-time and come to when the kids would come home from school so that I could fix their dinner or fulfill whatever needs that I was capable of doing at that time. I got very suicidal. My father's bank account was attached because my name was on it, and I was just devastated, and I had gotten drunk very early. I had had an opportunity to go to Omaha to my grandmother's funeral, and I stayed with my piano teacher, and she and her husband had been drinking partners of my mom and dad. And he had been sober 2 years in AA. Now, I never realized at the time what this was going to mean to me in the future. But he is the one who began to plant the seeds. And I love that because I really do believe that we plant lots of seeds and we need to plant lots of seeds. Because he planted them for me. And they didn't come into fruition until a couple of years later. But he had planted the seeds of Alcoholics Anonymous. He did not tell me his story, but his wife did. But he was an alcoholic who wrecked cars and went to jail and sat in the yard and shot the kids with his BB gun on their bicycles and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, a housewife drunk is not going to identify with that kind of a story. But, you see, I love that part in the 12 and 12. It says, once the nature of the malady of the alcoholic is planted in the mind of an alcoholic by another alcoholic, he is never the same. So whether you know whether it's working or not, it is working. It's working, and it is going into the subconscious. And it will come up when the time, you know, is right. And that's exactly what happens to me. And Jack kept touching me all the time, and it was making me really nervous. And he just said later, after I got sober, that he was giving me his spiritual energy, and I love that. And he said, anytime you have a chance, you know, even when your kids are in trouble or nothing, if you have a chance, hug them and touch them and just know that you're giving them spiritual energy. So, I mean, that had been a great tool for me that I used. Well, I came back and they attached my dad's bank account, called my sister, and then I decided I was going to kill myself, and there was a gun in the closet. And I got the gun down and was playing with the gun, sitting on the bed, putting it in my mouth, putting it in my head. And I later found out my 12-year-old daughter was standing at the doorway watching all this. And I'm going to tell you, there's sometimes we just have to live with the after effects of alcoholism until it heals. And it took years for this image to get out of this child's mind. She was 12 years old. And I would get calls that she'd had nightmares, and was I okay, and she'd be crying. And finally, I haven't had a call in 5 years. So, you know, I have to believe in my heart that that situation has finally been healed through my working the program and the prayer work, and her working the program and the prayer work. So anyway, instead of shooting myself, I decided to go to the phone, and for some wonderful spiritual reason, called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called the central office, and they answered, and they had somebody call me back. Well, by the time the person called me back, I had passed out. And so one of the girls answered the phone and said, could you please have them call her in the morning? So they did, and I went to my first meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's very interesting. I just started sponsoring a little girl, and that little girl is the daughter of the man who I heard give the first talk in AA at Glen Haven Stone Mountain. And I thought, oh, what a miracle. What a God thing, you know. And anyway, so I went there. I can't tell you much about it. There were no women there. I didn't leave with any phone numbers or anything like that. I don't remember much talk about sponsorship or anything like that, but I kept getting blown back by that. I used to think, why did I come? Some days I felt like I was right where I needed to be. And other days, it's kind of like I walked a tightrope. And other days I felt like, this is not where I need to be. When people are talking about mental institutes and jails and you know, all this kind of stuff, but I just couldn't identify with it. And then some days I would. And then I had and when I felt like I couldn't identify, I had to have a little break. So, you know, and I began to find out that what they were telling me about that first drink was true. And that what happened to me is when I'd start drinking, I would never stop. And so I began to learn by my own experience that what the people were telling me was really true. I had my last drink on the 14th of March. I hadn't planned for it to be my last drink. It just was. I'm forever grateful for that. I was into numerology. 14 was not my favorite number. I did not expect that. So I'm glad God was in charge instead of me. And things just began to happen. Somebody told me about a new group that had started. It was Clarkson. It was a step group. It was only the second step group in the city. The other one was John Funnister's group downtown. And I started going there. There were a bunch of old-timers. And I'm telling you, I love the time I got sober. Newcomers did not talk in meetings. They were not allowed to talk in meetings. And some of the meetings I go to today, I think that's still a pretty good idea. But it doesn't really go that way. But anyway, the old-timers were wonderful. And, you know, we came 30 minutes early, and we stayed 30 minutes after the meeting. If we had questions, that's when they talked to us. That's when they shared with us. That's when they gave us the answer. And then I told you about meeting my Cindy. And once I got a hold of her, she got me going, you know, on the path to sobriety. And it was just a wonderful thing. And as my life began to come together and I began to work the steps, and it was a step meeting at Clarkson, and I got interested in the traditions, because we did the traditions back then, even though a lot of the groups didn't do them. A lot of the groups don't do them today, but, you know, they were doing them back then. And so I started getting my life together. And as I got my life together, some people that I love a lot, lives begin to fall apart. My dad being the first one, you know, right before my first year birthday. And he decided I wasn't any fun to live with anymore. And I knew that he had chosen to come live with Al and I because of our lifestyle. And so he decided he'd go to Florida. So he went to Florida, and he went, got on a tube, ended up in the hospital, and we got a guy in my home group that says, you know, there just comes a time when you're drinking, there's no good drinking time left for you, you know. And they told my dad this, your drinking time is over. So he talked about coming to AA with me, and I'm so excited. And, you know, but I went to get him to take him home, and they were working on him, and he was gone. And I didn't understand, therefore, but for the grace of God. And I didn't understand a lot about, you know, universal law and principle and all that kind of stuff. And I was angry. Why had I been given this and he had not been given it? So I came back home, and between Cindy and the other people at Clarkson and everything, they held my hand until I got to the other side of the road, where I really realized that I didn't. You know, one of the greatest freedoms that I have had since being sober is I don't have to have the answer to everything anymore. And I used to have to think I needed the answer for everything. And I know today that I don't have to have the answer for everything. So they held my hand. Shortly after that, Lori, the middle daughter, became a runaway. We didn't know where she was. Heavily involved in drugs and alcohol. We didn't know where she was. It was a horrible time. We didn't know whether she was dead and alive or what was going on. Well, you know, we finally found her. We had the police arrest her, and we involuntarily committed her out at Parkwood, and Parkwood was still here. And I was at my Clarkston business meeting because, short of death, you never miss that business meeting. So anyway, I was there, and one of the old-timers asked me if I would be willing to serve the group as the GSR. And I told him I was real sorry that I wouldn't be able to do that because I just had too many personal problems. And he took me aside with another guy, and they talked to me about how service would really help me. It would get me out of myself. It would be really good for me. And I had a lot of personal problems going on. And, you know, as I look back over my life and my service life, it seems like every time I had a personal problem, God gave me another opportunity to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a wonderful time, and I loved service. I had a chance to go on and serve as the Georgia State Delegate, and also as the state chair, and then also serve 4 years as the Southeast Regional Trustee of New York on the board. And what a gift. What a gift. What an experience. And I think the most exciting thing about the whole thing was, what an opportunity to learn about how this thing really works from that level up there when you see, you know, the committee's work and you see all that stuff. You know, if we were left to our own resources, I'm sure we would not be meeting here tonight. You know, one good look in the mirror ought to be enough answer for any alcoholic. But we have these wonderful people who work with us and do all these things for us and take care of our relationship with religion and with medicine and with education and all this stuff. So that, you know, we don't have, Tanya up there talking for us. You know, we know nobody speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why we do it in the committee system, and it's such a blessing, and I think it's one of the reasons why we've been alive for so long. Shortly after, that, and my service was wonderful, Al was not getting any better, so Cindy and I went to the lawyer. I told this in her service, and she had said to me one other time, please don't tell people that. But Cindy and I went to the lawyer to sue Al for divorce. And right before he was to sign the papers, he ended up in the Augusta Medical Center with a heart deal. And he was all, and I mean, I was ready to move. Somebody in my home group says, you know, it takes us a long time to get ready to move, but boy, when we're ready, we're ready. And, you know, just get out of our way. So anyway, the doctor had told me, you know, he really needs a lot of tender loving care. You know, I walked in that room and he was hooked up to all these machines and everything. And I told him, I said, I hope you come and think this changed my mind because I'm divorcing you and you are out. And walked out. Lovingly and kindly. Never said a word. So anyway, I felt sorry for him because he didn't have any medical insurance. So anyway, I had the medical insurance. So I told him he could come home until the medical insurance paid for his hospitalization. Well, it took 10 months. For that medical insurance. And I mean, I don't know why I always consider myself rather bright. Why I didn't know that it would have paid anyway, but I didn't know that. Anyway, so I let him stay, and it took 10 months. And in that time, somebody said, leave her alone, let her do what she needs to do. You get yourself to Al and I. You start getting your life together, and you start, you know, getting some recovery for yourself, which is what he did. And in that 10 months, we started talking a little bit, and we learned a little bit about how to have a relationship, which neither one of us knew a thing about. We learned a little bit about how to respect each other, how to support each other, how to listen to each other, all that stuff. And, you know, it's really strange as I look at my relationship with Al. Really, I spent a lot of time trying to get him to love me like I thought he should love me. And then I spent 5 years after getting sober trying to find out how to get rid of him, and I couldn't get rid of him. And I just have to tell you now, I'm just so grateful he's in my life. I just can't think of anybody I would rather be alone with. And one last story on my youngest daughter, Allison, who was a drug addict. They have a piece of literature in NA that says, if you live with a drug addict, everything in your house develops feet and begins to walk. And everything in our house began to develop feet and walk. And Al and I were spending all of our spare time in pawn shops all over Memorial Drive trying to get her stuff back. And so we finally, with the advice from the Al-Anon and the AA people, put her on the street. Al Packer was crazy. Put her on the street. I thought I was going to die. But, you know, that was the beginning of her recovery. You know, that tough love is something else. I'm telling you, when you are powerless over your own life, that's one thing. But when you start getting powerless over those people you love so dearly, it is really a different ballgame. So, anyway, I have to tell you, the miracle of AA is awesome. I work for her today. And she has a little insurance agency. And I do all of her paperwork for her. And she'd wanted me to come to work for her for quite some time, and I didn't know whether that would work, because, you know, that family stuff sometimes doesn't work for you. But anyway, it worked beautifully. And I just have such a great relationship with her. She's wonderful to work with. She's so good to us. And we're really, really grateful. And when I was 15 years sober, I went back and played the piano in the bar. I had tried to do this and tried to do this, had agreement with Cindy and my family and everything that if it didn't interfere with my sobriety, I could do it. See, I'm a jazz pianist, so that's where I have to go if I'm going to work. So, and I'm a great bar lover. I love the lights and the mirrors and the bottles and the glasses and all that thing. So, I mean, I really had a hard time. And then, you know, I finally got back. I worked 12 and a half years at the jazz club in Underground until he finally sold it. And I knew every time I got on that panel bench, I was in God's territory, and I was safe. And it was wonderful. I never thought that would ever be possible for me. So, you know, I just have come to believe that everything is possible if you stay sober, you know, and believe in God, and do the steps and the tradition. I'm very, very grateful. Thank you, Tanya, for asking me to come and share with the group. Yeah. I love you all, and I thank you so much for my life. Thank you.